I'm going to call to order the March 13th Ways and Means Committee hearing. We do have a quorum. Representative Hornstein moves approval of the March 5th minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The March 5th minutes are adopted. Members of the audience and committee members that haven't been able to get your email today, the Banyan bill that was originally posted on the agenda will not be heard tonight. So for any of you that are in the room, just for that, that will not be heard this evening. The first bill that is up on our agenda is House File 2738, Representative Kiffmeyer. And members, for those of you who haven't been outside, it's about 70 degrees, sunny and warm. Most of the state of Minnesota is barbecuing or throwing balls around in their backyard. So, nice. Representative Kiffmeyer, if you'd like to move your bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 2738 for a recommendation to pass and to be referred to the Committee on Rules.
All right, thank you. And if I might, there are a couple of amendments in our packets. My understanding is that they are both your amendments.
Yes, Madam Chair.
What would be your pleasure? Who you want?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the HF 2738, the A2 amendment.
All right, members, Representative Kiffmeyer moves the A2 amendment to House File 2738. You'd like to explain the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, yes. On line 1.19, we are striking two words, identity and after listening to members and testimony in the last committee hearing, there were some concerns, and so we decided to simplify this language by removing the two words, identity and, which leaves us in a simpler language at this time, and also a clear direction for the implementation of the constitutional amendment should it pass.
All right, thank you. Members, are there any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Kiffmeyer, also have an A5 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move the adoption of the 2738 A5 amendment.
You'd like to explain it to the committee?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We had a fixed deadline of June 30th, 2013, but in listening to the election administrators, a variety of groups, that by giving a window between the effective date and the first election that would be used under this new constitutional amendment, it gives a window of time for the election administrators to get ready.
All right. Are there any questions on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A5 amendment is adopted. Representative Kiffmeyer, I think we have the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss. And members, the fiscal note that's in your packet addresses, which is a pretty typical cost for constitutional amendments, that of $2,000. Earlier last year, actually, we let a bill go out of here of $3,000 of Representative Kahn's as a nominal amount. This falls underneath that level. And I don't know if there's any additional questions on the bill as the amendment. Certainly we'd stand for those at this time. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, you know, I know that the main reason the bill is here is that cost of the $2,000, but this is, of course, a constitutional amendment. It remains very controversial, and I do have a couple of questions of the author. And Representative Kiffmeyer, could you tell me how many senior citizens would not have a photo ID with a valid address, you know, where they've either let their driver's license lapse because they no longer drive, or perhaps are in a long-term care facility or senior high-rise, and they simply don't have a photo ID with an address?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Carlson and members. There is no requirement that the ID itself would have to have their current address on it. As Minnesota law currently allows, proof of residency can be used with your driver's license, a state identification card, variety of things like that. But proving your residency, Minnesota state law allows for a variety of ways to prove your residency, and that would apply to seniors and whatever living arrangement they might be.
So,
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, you did indicate a couple of proofs. Now, are you saying there's going to be no change in current law as a result of this in terms of the kind of proof of address that you can bring in? And Madam Chair, one of the reasons I'm asking this question, it was not in Minnesota, but it was in another state that had a similar law, and you maybe saw it on the news. The man was 80-some years old. His driver's license had expired, and he was a World War II vet, if I recall, and he was denied the right to vote because his driver's license was expired. And so what would that kind of circumstance be here in Minnesota if your constitutional amendment goes on the ballot and passes?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Carlson and members. When you have a identity tool, if I can back up a little bit, there are two requirements. One is your identity. An identity is proof of who you are. Residency is proof of where you live or you're claiming residency at the time. And so, such as in the case of students, you might have a student housing list. In the case of a nursing home, you might be able to have the administrator of the nursing home certify as to residency. If you have somebody in another situation, current law allows for items like a utility bill with their name on it and that it's current within the last 30 days. So there are a variety of ways that you are able to show your residency. And in fact, Representative Carlson and members, in future legislation, many of those proofs of residency are able to be there as well. So I think that proof of identity is a matter of who you are, and those two are very different. And so for this gentleman in regards to residency, he would have a variety of options here in Minnesota.
So, Madam Chair, when you say yes, the management of the nursing home could certify residency, what would that entail?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson and members, in many cases, and we have this in current law right now, that if you are living in a long-term care facility, most of the time we know this, that when they come in, we know who they are. And their residency, they're not moving around a lot more at that particular time of their life. And so currently, they often vote an absentee ballot, and they use the nursing home as their residency for that period of time. I would anticipate in some future legislation, should this amendment pass, that we, the legislature, would work together in a bipartisan fashion to make sure that anybody in that situation would have a pathway for both identity and for residency.
And
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I indicated I had a couple of questions, and the other one, there's been conversation about a so-called government ID being used or issued. So what kinds of government ID would be acceptable?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
And thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Carlson and members. Government-issued ID could be a driver's license, could be a Minnesota state identification card, two most common forms. Passport could be use of an ID. A military ID, current law allows tribal ID. Those are regularly understood to be government-issued identification.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, you mentioned a moment ago college students. What would be the status of an ID issued by a college or university in Minnesota?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson and members, the status of a college student ID, some of them are issued by the University of Minnesota, some are college students. But in a previous bill, and I would anticipate for next year as well, that one thing we as legislators could do is to allow a student use an out-of-state ID. Again, your ID not changing, and a government issued for a student could be from another state.
And
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, where I'm headed with the question about colleges, we have tens of thousands of students who would have a college ID, but it's not issued by a unit of government. They might be attending a St. Olaf or a St. Thomas or a Concordia. It would be a private institution that's technically then not a government entity, but yet they would have a student ID. So what would be the status of our private colleges and universities so that there would be a level playing field between those that are attending a public institution then that I think you were just saying would be giving a government ID because they are a government entity? And under law, by the way, Minsky is technically a state agency. The U of M is constitutionally autonomous. I'm not quite sure how that plays, but let's assume that they're both considered government for a moment. The question of the private colleges and universities, what about their ID? Would that be acceptable or not?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson and members, when you have a court case situation, you do have, you need to be very careful about treating voters, especially in a particular group, give them equal treatment. And so if you have some students that would have a official state university type of an ID and other students don't, but I think, Representative Carlson, that the large majority of those students, if they do not have a Minnesota driver's license or a state ID card, that they would have, if they are here from another state, those students would probably have another state identity card that could be useful for students that would give them all a equal level playing field for them to make sure that if this is the state that they are claiming residency in, that they want to vote in the state of Minnesota, claim that residency, that that ID for that student, even from another state, could be very useful in that case, and that would be a government-issued ID.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that answered my question about level playing field with between a private college or university and a public college and university. You said students all have to be treated the same, I think is the way you were putting it, Representative Kiffmeyer. But maybe you could just kind of give me a yes or no. Would a student attending a private college be able to use a student ID, assuming it's a photo ID, and I think most of them are, in lieu of a government-issued ID?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, and members. When the court talks about a group of voters and treating them in an equal way, it doesn't have to be identical. In other words, creating a way for them to have an ID that is a government-issued ID is the issue that is of concern. And as long as those students have that and have that ability to have that ID, the courts don't say exactly what kind it has to be. There are some students that might be overseas. They could use a passport. We might have some folks that are in the military. They can use their military ID. There's a variety of cases like this. The court is interested in making sure that they have the opportunity to have an ID, but whether it's exactly the same, that all of those things, the point is that they have a pathway, that they have the ability to have an ID. And I believe that we would be able to work together on that, Representative Carlson, and that we would be able to see to it that every single student, every eligible voting student here in the state of Minnesota would have that opportunity to vote and to have that identification needed.
No, Madam Chair, I'm sure that simply, quite frankly, is not clear to me. Let's take the Moorhead area where you have, I'll use my son as an example. He attended school in the Moorhead area, and there's three higher ed institutions up there, one in North Dakota and two in Minnesota. And between my son and his two roommates, they attended all three institutions. So on the Moorhead side, one is public, one is private. They would have lived at the same address, same precinct, and I don't think you're giving me a clear answer in terms of whether the Concordia student could use a Concordia ID with his or her photo on it at the same time they're trying to vote. The one's got on one issued, then let's say by Moorhead State, and the other's by Concordia. And you're saying that they could approach and get other forms of ID, but I'm just asking if they could use their school ID at both a public and a private institution. I think you're telling me no, that they one at the private institution would have to go and get a another form of ID that would be government issued because Concordia is not a government entity.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I believe those students all have an ID of one sort or another at already, just because the student ID in their particular case, if they don't want to use it, if they want to use their driver's license, if they want to use their state ID card, if they want to use a driver's license or ID from another state, we're not restricting them that it has to be one sort or another, but simply the interest that we have is that they are able to have an ID and to use it as needed for voting.
Representative Carlson.
Now, Madam Chair, I think maybe others will have questions, but I think I'm getting, at least in my view, kind of a vague answer here in terms of the equitable treatment between a college student who would be in two different situations. I understand that they maybe have alternatives to go out and get other official government IDs, but it still sounds to me like if the situation were two students, one attending a public and one attending a private, wanted to use a student ID, one could and one could not. But I'll stop at that point and let others ask questions. Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, I know a bunch of other states have this. They almost always have it in law. Only one other state has it in their constitution, I gather. But I understand, and I'm certainly not an expert, so I'd like to pose this to you as a question.
Representative Kahn, if you're talking to a microphone, people might be able to hear you.
Yeah, I understand, and I'm asking you this as much more of an expert than I am on this subject, that many other states have the ability to have lots of kinds of ID, you know, industrial ID, employee ID, even fitness club ID. What you're trying to do is you're trying to match a photo with the person that appears before you. Is the whole point of ID as such. And so the, Representative Carlson has pointed out one specific inequity. But I understand other states with ID have had a much, they just don't have the language government-issued ID as part of it. And so I think that would help some of us with that bill. If that will loosen up a little bit. Or broaden, whichever way you want to look at it. I'm just asking you about what you know about other states.
Representative Kiffmeyer, Representative Connie Carlson, too, as you're well aware, there will also be a process of enactment language should this pass, following that. So some of this will be addressed, in that process. But Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, the problem I have is exactly what we write into the Constitution. For example, if we write ID, then we can, by law, enact government-issued ID. But if we write government-issued ID, we can't then broaden it out in the law if someone raises this issue of unfairness between
them. I understand that. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kahn and members. Other states, some of them do, and in those statutory bills, but Representative Kahn, those are changing. There are many states now that are progressing to the route of using a government-issued form of photographic identification rather than all of those other ones. And it isn't just the photo. Matter of fact, I remember several folks on this side of the aisle who said, well, a photo, people grow hair, they shave their hair, they grow beards, they do things, they gain weight, they lose weight. And so the photos themselves are not as substantial. But it does give you a general idea. But the real context is when you hold that ID in your hand and it matches the name on the roster and you're holding it, and the resemblance of age and a variety of other factors, it's all of that together that really have give that strength to that ID requirement. And matter of fact, Missouri is putting this on the ballot in their November election on November 12th of this year. They're also putting it on the ballot. So there's a number of states where, in regards to what's in current law, that things are changing. I'm sure there is much more of a mobile society these days, and an understanding of many times the need to show your identity, prove your identity in a variety of ways. So the direction and the trend in the future is to go towards what we are proposing in this constitutional amendment.
Who said that?
I've heard that maybe states are changing. Is Missouri putting it on the ballot to be a constitutional amendment then? Or is it just...
Madam Chair,
Representative
yes.
Kiffmeyer.
Okay. But
go ahead.
You know, I still have... My concern is writing the kind of language into the Constitution that we want to change. I don't have as big a concern of having a broad enough language in the Constitution so that we can very much tighten it up and we can move to something like government-issued ID if that's something that we think we should do.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Members, I have Representative Champion on as answering questions. I didn't have anybody on the list beyond Representative Carlson. There were members of the Pension Commission that came up to vote. So if I might, by a show of hands, how many of you have questions on this particular bill, because I want to get the pension people back to pensions if it's going to go a while so they can continue working.
Thank you.
So we have Representative Champion, Hornstein, anybody else? All right.
Madam Speaker, I'd like to have a roll call when you get back.
That's great, but I'm not the Speaker.
Oh.
Not going there, Representative Carlson. Representative Champion, is your question fairly brief? And yours as well, Representative Hornstein? All right, thank you. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Kiffmeyer, you know, I noticed that you said in your earlier testimony that the fiscal note is zero for 12, and then there's a $2,000 fiscal note for the Secretary of State's office for 2013. Would you be so kind, because I know that you've had an opportunity to review this fiscal note and have analyzed it backwards and forward, can you walk through some of the local impacts that are not represented from a state agency and help us get a sense of what sort of costs would be placed on our local government?
And Representative Champion, if you are interested, on page 3 of the fiscal note, they're outlined as well. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is customary language in regards to the $2,000 that it is looked upon as the amount for the Secretary of State, and I would expect that would be the cost that you can see there on that line. Just to let you know, it says local government costs to county auditors of adding one proposed constitutional amendment to optical scan ballots, the cost on programming and counting votes, estimated cost for printing and publishing. Just to mention in regards here that local units of government print ballots, and it's always been fascinating to me that when you pay for anything to be copied or printed, whether it uses more black ink or less, it still costs so much money to just simply print. And so the fact that you add one more item to be on the ballot is just a matter of it may be a cost and it may not be a cost, but this year in our ballot, we also don't have the executive offices on the ballot. It's a little bit shorter ballot overall, and I would expect they would be able to accomplish this in one ballot as they usually do, and the normal printing costs.
Follow, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, it's my understanding that this amendment will call for the state to provide free photographic identification cards to all eligible voters. And it's my understanding, as I read this and wanted to get your reaction to it, is that there's a lack of clarity as to who will provide that, but it appears that there's an estimated cost of $1.1 million in the first biennium, and then there would be some additional money from the special revenue fund. Is that consistent with what you understand, or do you believe that cost is a phantom cost?
Representative Chevy, and I don't know if you were in the room when we adopted the amendments, and they're certainly, I'm not disputing the cost issue, but what you need to know is that the effective date of this was changed with the A5 amendment, so the implementation cost should be borne in the next biennium, and as part of the implementation process, the legislature next year would then provide the funding for those services. But Representative Kiffmeyer.
But Madam Chair, just for clarity, thank you so much for that clarification, but I guess more of my question is whether it is funded this year or next year. Is that a real cost that still should be lifted up and realized as a part of this discussion as we talk about the fiscal implications of this bill?
All right, thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Champion and members. Yeah. Without question that if the state is issuing and the state is providing and paying for those IDs at no charge to the eligible voters, that in the future there would be that cost. And matter of fact, especially to have those who are economically disadvantaged, who are on the poor level of society, those who are minorities of color, in a variety of areas, especially in the inner city, to be able to have a state identification card issued to them at no charge is a tremendous value that I think that has been well recognized, not just in being able to use it in the voting process, but in other parts of the economy as well.
Representative Champion?
Yes. Oh, Father. Oh, there you go. Well, I heard this male voice. I was like, oh, who is the male voice? Okay. Thank you so very much. I do have another follow-up. So you will agree that there's also some impact that this bill would have.
Representative Champion, if I might.
Okay.
Representative Rukavina has now added his name to the list, so I'm going to excuse the Pension Commission members. Go back to your committee. When everybody's done with their questions, we'll take a break and let them come back. So, I'm sorry. Representative Champion.
Thank you. So, Representative Kiffmeyer, so I guess with your response, it will lead me to believe that you do understand that by requiring individuals to have a photographic ID would have some impact on seniors and people of color. Is that right? Would you like for me to phrase the question a different way? Because you look perplexed, and I want to be as helpful as possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Champion. It would have some effect in the sense that they would be issued a, if they need it, if they don't already have it, they would be issued a ID as required by the Constitutional Amendment as would be implemented by the legislature.
No further questions.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, along the lines that Representative Champion was asking in terms of cost, it's my understanding that you get a free ID, but yet you still have to show certain documents to prove your identity. Is that correct?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein and members. In accordance with the Department of Public Safety, there are a variety of options as far as proving your identity. We would use their current checklist of any documents that are required by them in regards to getting something like a state ID card.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, for example, some of these documents are a birth certificate. My understanding is that costs $45, a passport, $97, naturalization papers, $200. So there are going to be costs borne by individuals, and when we have over 10%, 10.5% of Minnesotans 65 and older do not have some form of photo ID. We have 84,000 voters without a driver's license or state ID card. Yes. Another 131,000 with an address on their ID that's different than their current residence. You know, those are huge numbers. And so then we're going to have all of these individuals then having to pay for these documents that, you know, are required by the Department of Public Safety to get identity. So I think there's a huge cost to these individuals, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein and members, the U.S. Court, as well as other state courts, have heard this question in regards to the birth certificate and other derived documents. Some states do make provision for that. Some states do not. But the courts have also recognized that if there are those costs, the courts have allowed that they will be legitimate for the purpose of proving your identity. And in particular, Minnesota, we have a variance process that is a one-page form that can be used as well. And that can be a $10 application fee for that. So without question, Representative Horstein, that in the future legislature, those are the kinds of questions that we would want to consider.
Madam Chair, just quickly, just a comment. I think that we're going to have a lot of voters falling through the cracks under this legislation. A lot of people who are eligible to vote now won't be able to vote, and they will be incurring, whether it's $10 or $200 for naturalization costs or passports, birth certificates, everything in between, individuals will be incurring significant costs, and I think that's important for the record.
Madam Chair, just to let you know that in U.S. Supreme Court and other state courts, there isn't a single documented case of any voter being disenfranchised through a voter ID requirement, even if it includes getting such things as a birth certificate or other proof of identity. So, indeed, I'm confident that in Minnesota we will also implement it in a fair way to preserve everybody's right to vote and eligibility to vote.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Rukavina.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, you know, as a former Secretary of State, I know how proud you are of Minnesota's turnout and how proud we all are. And I'm a little concerned about some of the things in here. And so I just got a few quick questions. You know, if you look at your bill, you know, you have to be a resident of the United States for 3 months, and you have to be in the precinct for 30 days. And then there's a procedure if you haven't been in the precinct for 30 days. And so if I have a constituent who moves from the range to go to school in St. Cloud in August, then they're eligible to vote in November, even if they have a driver's license or a, you know, a photo ID from, let's say, St. Cloud State. How do they... But their, you know, their address is Virginia, Minnesota. How are they going to be able to vote under your legislation here?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rukavina. The important thing is they will be able to vote. Students are able to vote either an absentee ballot from their home address, or if they're changing residency to match their school address, they are able to do that as well. So either way, they will certainly be able to execute their right to vote and to be able to prove their identity and residency will be well accomplished, Representative Rukavina. And so I think that, by the way, just to clarify on that constitutional language, that 30 days is in regards to when you are moving, and it just makes sure you can vote from your previous residence if you're during those 30 days. But as far as Minnesota's statute, it is 20 days in the state residency, and that constitutional language has to do about being in the precinct.
Okay, but so I'm still not sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, because you just said they can vote. They can vote at home, but maybe they didn't think about it, so they're going to have a hard time getting an absentee ballot or whatever, or they're going to have to drive 3 hours to go and vote, or they're going to have a photo ID that's legitimate that says their address is Virginia, Minnesota, and it doesn't say it's St. Cloud, even though they've met the 20-day requirement or the 30-day requirement or whatever. So how do they vote in St. Cloud?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, under this language, under this constitutional amendment language, it gives sufficient flexibility to accommodate all voters to be able to cast their ballot.
But...
Representative Karina,
you're telling me that, but I know what happens when we pass laws around here. What we intended to happen doesn't happen. So what I'm asking you is, did I just give an example of a person who is legitimately able to vote in St. Cloud, and now you're trying to tell me that somehow they're going to get to vote even though they have an ID that's legitimate, that's a photo of their license plate or whatever, but it says Mary Mackey lives in Virginia, Minnesota, but she's trying to vote on the campus of St. Cloud.
Representative Rukavina, we came in a little late, so I think you missed it.
I miss everything, Madam Chair.
The photo ID does not have to have an address that matches their residence where they're voting.
I'm aware of that. I am asking, how is that person from Virginia, Minnesota, who's now moved to the campus of St. Cloud, who's going to verify to let them vote in the election in St. Cloud? And I haven't gotten an answer yet.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina, it's real straightforward. Current law allows them to prove their residency in a variety of ways. And so they will be able to prove their residency. The purpose of an ID is to prove who they are, not necessarily where they live. And so those two are separate issues. Proving who they are is done with an ID. Where they live can either be on that same ID or a variety of other ways that are in current Minnesota law.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Kiffmeyer. You know, voting is a right, not a privilege, and it's mentioned, I think, in four different amendments to the United States Constitution. So this is an important issue. And I want to know, so are you telling me then if Mary Mackey from Virginia, Minnesota has a different address on her photo ID, that all she has to do is drag along somebody else that's got an ID from Buell, let's say, and they can both say together, yes, we live here now. We've lived here since August 31st. Are you telling me that will be the way this works?
Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina, there is no vouching for residency, and so they would need to prove their residency just as any other grown-up person 18 years and older would need to do in whatever methodology is allowed by state law. And so if their ID is their ID, Madam Chair, I believe I'm just repeating the same thing and it's not a good use of your time.
Well,
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, voting is a right, not a privilege, and I'm worried that this is going to take people's rights away that are guaranteed in the Constitution, and I'm trying to get an answer because I have a lot of kids who move away and who are very active politically. Most of them vote right. They vote for me when they were home. But I want to make sure that they can vote right in St. Cloud, and I don't think I've gotten that answer. But let me ask you another one. How, Madam Chair, if I could, how does a homeless veteran, and there are many of them, prove their residency if they're moving from precinct to precinct? In your, how do they prove that, you know, and a veteran certainly should be able to vote. How do they, how hard is it, how difficult it is for them, is it going to be for them to be able to vote if this passes?
Representative Kiffmeyer, and then following this, Representative Gottwald.
Representative Rukavina, I expect it to be as easy for them to vote by once they have that ID or if they have one already. Current law allows them to claim an address. They're entitled to one vote, just like anybody else. And so I would expect that in future legislation, we will absolutely work together to make sure that homeless veterans or anybody in that situation or anybody at all is able to cast their ballot as the right to do so. But they also have qualifications in the Constitution in the exercising of their right. And we have those to respect as well.
And Representative Gottwald, to this point?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to represent Rukavina's question about how do you get somebody who lives away from the college, moves to the college close to the election. Representative Kiffmeyer, maybe you can answer this, but is it not current law and current practice that the college would print out a list of registered students and get that to the polling location, and then that student would simply present their ID, match it up with the list, and they get to vote? Is that, I mean, that happens under current law. Isn't that what would happen here, too?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Gutwell, what happens under current law is the student housing list, the requirement of the ID along with it would be those two together. Again, the identity and the residency and student housing, yes.
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Gutwell, by the way, I've told them not to vote for you in the past, too, but anyway. Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, final question. You know, I live in a little rural township, Pike Township, and I voted there for 37 years, I think, now. So when I walk in, kind of relating to Representative Champion's question on real costs here, when I walk into that polling place, there's usually about, six people, and most of them are ladies, and, you know, they know who I am. And they don't ask me for an ID, and a lot of times it gets crowded there. Now, even though Doreen Mackey's known me for
35 years. Does she have to ask me for an ID? Does she have to ask her cousin Frank for an ID, or her husband? Does she have to ask everybody, even though they've known him for 50 years? And if that is the case, how many more hours are these election judges going to be working? And they don't work for free. They get paid. I don't know. I think they're reimbursed by the township or the local unit of government. And this is going to happen all over Minnesota. Does everybody have to show an ID in that line? Because now I walk in and say, "Hi, Tommy, how you doing? Here's your thing. You know, I'm going to go over there and put it in the box, go in the booth, vote, come back. Hey, how you doing? Give me that little voter sticker." And now I got to pull out my wallet, get in the line. Is that what's going to happen?
Madam Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
And Representative Rukavina and members, if the constitutional amendment passes, and the Constitution then would require for you to present your photo ID when you go in the polling place on election day, yes, you would be required to do that. And not everybody is like your township. That's wonderful that Hyde Township is that small, but not everybody is Hyde Township. We want to make sure that we have equal treatment of all voters. You can't say, well, we'll exempt Representative Rukavina because everybody knows him. We have a situation here where when you go to the polling place to vote on election day, this is what is required. And I'm sure, Representative Rukavina, knowing the law as well as you do, you would quickly have that ID out and just expedite the process. And don't give those little lady election judges any grief.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative Rukavina
and Representative, they would expect nothing less from me. But I do have to tell you that, you know, there's about 400 people in our township, and many of them are seeing, I don't think we have that many kids, and most of them are voters, and there's a high voter turnout, and that's going to slow down the process, and they're going to be there another hour or maybe 2 hours, and I'll bet you that Representative Eaton knows the same thing in his township, maybe even Representative Wagenius, that in her precinct, those election judges know almost everybody. And now they're going to, Representative Champion asked the right question. They're all going to be there. The lines are going to get longer. They work from 7 in the morning till 11 at night, and now they're going to be there till maybe 12, 1 in the morning. Hmm. And there's 6 of them, or 7 or 8 of them. And that's another hour or two of work, and multiply that by the tens of thousands.
Representative Rukavina, do you know what the temperature is outside?
Well, it's getting hotter in here for me right now. I know that. But
I'm Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina. Having been an election judge myself for 11 years prior to becoming Secretary of State, there are many times, because I live in a larger township, 3 precincts now, a lot bigger population. Matter of fact, it's even bigger than our city. And many times when I was working as an election judge, I would think to myself, why can't we just have somebody show their ID, and this would go a lot faster than guessing if you are Lawrence, Larry, LT, William, Bill, Will, Anderson, O-N-E-N-S-O-H-N. Sometimes, how many times working as an election judge, I thought, we would just have a simple show me your ID that I could have that. It would really help speed the process up.
Well, Madam Chair and Andy, I think it's going to certainly cost a lot more hours and cost a lot more money just for the ID part of it.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Representative Champion, very quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that I was looking at you, and I'm thinking of that sunny weather outside as well. But I was really just trying to concentrate on the fiscal implications of this bill, and I was really just going to let it go by without raising this issue. But I think I will raise it because I think it's worth considering. As I sit here, I'm thinking of history. And I'm thinking of history from a number of perspectives. I know that in 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. Well, the executive order came forth. In 1865, the others, you know, folks, especially African Americans, realized that they were free. 1857, Dred Scott came forth. And it wasn't until 1868, when the 14th Amendment was signed, that allowed citizenship to be considered. if you look at Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, you will see that men could vote, but women could not. It wasn't until the 15th Amendment that allowed for the others to be able to vote. But there are several things that happened between, you know, the passing of the 15th Amendment and when others really tried to vote. There was this thing that was called a poll tax. And that poll tax was often put in place in order to disenfranchise people, especially people of color in the South, from being able to vote. And there was a reason for the Civil Rights Act of 1965. The reason for that is because they wanted to be assured that there was going to be an opportunity, that no one was going to infringe upon their right to vote. And so I know that this is a long way to get to my question.
Your short question.
My short question.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, what can you say that is going to reassure people of color and others that this is not a new disguised version of the poll tax in the year 2012?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Champion. First of all, I'm sure that some folks have gone through an experience like that and have a special sensitivity. We recognize that. And I have worked very hard in the election system during my years to defend and protect and to get voter information out, speaking at Martin Luther King Day, just going to numerous times, and greatly enjoyed it. When you have the question of the poll tax, the courts have taken a look at this matter in regards to the Harper case and the question of it being a poll tax, and the courts have said it is not a poll tax.
You finished, Representative Champion?
Well, I did ask you just for a short opportunity, so I will not keep trying my luck with the chair.
All right, thank you. Members, we are in recess until approximately 7 p.m. so that we can get everybody in the room for the roll call vote. Members, we're going to reconvene the Ways and Means Committee hearing. Representative Kiffmeyer renews her motion that House File 2738 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to rules, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right, and Representative Carlson requested a roll call. Mr. Smith, if you will take the roll, please.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Downey.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Yes. Mike.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Brainerd.
No.
Representative Biskins.
Yes.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Davids.
Yes.
Representative Eakin.
No.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Gottwald.
Yes.
Representative Greiling.
No.
Representative Gunther.
Yes.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative House.
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Representative Lanning.
Yes.
Representative Lincheski. Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Representative Nornes.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski.
No.
Representative Rukavina.
No.
Representative Slawik.
No.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
No.
Representative Westrum.
Yes.
Representative Lincheski.
Photo ID.
No. Thank you, and the vote was 18 ayes, 12 nays. Representative Kiffmeyer, your House File 2738, recommended pass as amended, referred to rules.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Lanning, thank you very much. The next item on the agenda will be House File 2087, Representative Lemire.
in the room.
Oh, we're going to do 287.
Might as well do
members, I'll move House File 2087 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lemire. If you'd like to briefly explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Should I just stick to the revenue?
That works for me.
All right. This is an agency housekeeping bill for the Department of Labor and Industry, and it has a positive fiscal note of $25,000 in 13, and continues with a $32,000 positive fiscal note for the years after. And the numbers come from the $10 per year fee for residential building contractors, electrical contractors, and billing officials. Open any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Lemire. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I noticed a few changes in the bill where we changed journeyman to journey worker. I did ask the chair about that, and he informs me that under the apprenticeship program that is a federal requirement or a request from the federal government. And Madam Chair, being a sensitive new millennia guy, I noticed in one spot where it wasn't changed, so I would like to move that on page 2, line 30, we strike the word journeyman and we insert the word journey workers.
With a photo ID.
Members, are there any questions on the Biskin's oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Are there any questions on the bill as amended? Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, for you and Chair Davids, there is a fee in this bill, and they generally go to tax committee. Did you guys miss that? Or
mm-hmm. It was there.
Was in tax committee.
Representative Davids.
I don't recall.
Yeah, I'm looking at the front of the bill. I don't think.
That. Madam Chair?
Representative Lemire.
If it'd be all right, could I bring up Mr. Rakowski from the Department of Labor? I believe that that's a fee that already exists.
Doesn't matter.
Well, we have the chair taxes here. Representative David, what's your call on this? We can certainly amend our...
Well, I'd like to hear from Mr. Rakowski.
Welcome to the committee.
Oh, it's a joy to be here this evening, members. Thank you. John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. The author is indeed correct. We anticipate the new businesses being created. This is, you could call this a new jobs bill, because we anticipate about 1,500 some new businesses being started, mostly in the building contractor, residential building contractor industry, and the next biggest would be in the electrical. Those of you familiar with the trades, it's a churning industry. People retire, or they, Lemire turns it over to Lemire and Sons, so the son would get the license. This is no change in the fee structure. It's just anticipating this new revenue. We are a fee-for-service driven department, and so I defer to the tax chair, but I don't think it needs to go there. It went to Senate Finance. It didn't go to Senate Taxes, if that matters.
Chair Davids.
You're not helping yourself.
No.
No, I don't need
providing information.
All right. Representative Lucheski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, I heard the tax chair, and he doesn't want to see it. Unfortunately, that's not what the statute says. It's not really if the chair wants to see it. There's a statute, and the statute says a fee is a tax, and this was brought forward by Representative Krinke when he was the tax chair, and Senator Pogemiller when he was the tax chair. So it's passed in conference committee, and it said that that's what we're going to do, and there have been attempts to get rid of that piece of legislation, but I think the new majority actually has opposed that. I guess I will just say, you know, folks are in charge here, so they get to set the rules, but I just wanted on the record that this is in violation of Minnesota statute, and in fact, this is the third or fourth time this has happened in this last biennium. So, you know, certainly it is a small amount, but you could be cutting a fee, Madam Chair, and it would need to go to taxes. It's not about if it goes up or down or new or old. It's that it's got a revenue impact for the state. So I understand that you're going to push this through to the floor, and I'll just leave it at that. But I think the new majority may want to revisit the law if they don't like it, because not really been adhering to it. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Biskin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And with all due respect to the former tax chair, I think we're reading far too much into the law. If the state of Minnesota were to incorporate a program which would encourage more people to go fishing, and then more people, of course, going fishing would create more people paying fishing licenses, that bill would not go to taxes. If a bill which would allow more people, encourage more people to get driver's license, which would mean that more people would pay the fee for a driver's license, more people. We're not changing the fee. It's not being amended up or down. It's just more people being involved in that activity. That would not go to taxes. What we have here, as I heard the testimony, is that we're just going to have more people engaged in the activities of residential builder contractors, of electricians, and building officials. And that is where this note is coming from. It's not through an increase up or down, but through an increase in activity. And in none of those scenarios would those bills go through taxes.
Well, I heard it's Representative Garofalo's anniversary, and so I did not move for it to go to taxes, but I think, you know, maybe people want to keep talking about it, but I'll just help you out, Madam Chair, in the rule, and Chair Davids, you have the ability, and there is a statute, to confer as these two chairs and to make a determination, and, you know, I guess if you would do that on a regular basis, then you could meet the rule. And cite it on the House floor when we bring these things up, but it's not really my job to coach you into your own rules, but I am not going to make that motion, and I won't make it on the floor either. But I do think when we have statutes and we have things in rule, we should try to follow them, and rather than kind of creatively working our way through some and not others. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Lanchesky, and whenever Chair Davids and I arm wrestle, he wins. So, and if you might, you might want to review the House Rule 410, Paragraph C, as well. Are there any other comments on the bill before us, as amended by Representative Biskins? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2087, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. You are on your way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Garofalo, who's next?
Yeah, can I go?
It's up to you.
Anniversary.
All right, we are going to take up House File 2083. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 2083 be recommended to pass and referred to, is it Rules or the General Register, Madam Chair?
My understanding is it should go to the General Register.
So the General Register, and Madam Chair, let me start off by, we have an amendment, the A-17 amendment. I'll move the A-17 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, members, I've been advised that people may view data practices information as being something that should be contained in data practices bills and not as part of an omnibus bill, so We're going to delete this section of the bill.
And Representative Garofalo, I really support your A-17 amendment. Members, are there any questions on the A-17 amendment? It removes a Chapter 13 provision that's in this bill related to disclosure of settlements by school employees. And that bill is moving separately. Was heard in data practice. The subcommittee was, in fact, amended last night, and should probably not move in this fashion, this bill. So if there's no questions, Representative Garofalo moves the A-17 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A-17 amendment is adopted. Representative Garofalo, what's your pleasure next?
I have no additional amendments, Madam Chair.
All right. Would you like to explain the bill, then?
Madam Chair and members, House File 2083 pays down our shift from its current level, or increases the payment shift from 64.3 to 70.2.
This does this by taking roughly $430 million from the cash balances of our account and transferring those to our schools to accelerate and pay back our schools, in addition to the $318 million that took place automatically as part of the February forecast. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Are there any questions on the A? I'm sorry, the House File 2083, and my understanding is at some point we have the A22 amendment that will be offered. Are there any questions before that? Seeing that, Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, depending on how you want to proceed, my questions in part would be answered with the discussion on the A22 amendment. So,
certainly, if you'd like to move it at this time,
if you'd like to take the amendment up at this point. So, Madam Chair, I move the A22 amendment.
All right.
And, Madam Chair, the amendment closes corporate loopholes for offshore corporations and uses the revenue to permanently pay off the school shift. And under House File 2028, there is no plan to permanently pay off the shift. When the shifts are paid off, then the money would go into the general fund as it's crafted. Loopholes closed in the amendment are the foreign royalty subtraction, FOCs, unitary tax havens, foreign partnership income, and it raises $194 million in fiscal year 13, $152 million in fiscal 14, and $157 million in fiscal 15. And a couple of things that I would point out then, Madam Chair, about the amendment. Unfortunately, the bill before us doesn't look long range and really put in place a permanent way to pay off the shift. The other thing is that this does, with the tax issue for foreign operating corporations and so on, it does provide a stream of revenue. And one of the reasons that I'm very interested in this, we did request, and we didn't have it available last night, but some information from OMD on cash flow. And that did come through today. And in fiscal 23, statutory general fund, I'm reading now from a memo from OMD, fund balance shows 1 month has a negative low point of $184 million in October 2012. And six other months, September, November, December, January, March, and April, where the statutory general fund cash balance is positive but below $400 million. And the history of OMB is that you do, or they try to, for good fiscal management, maintain a balance of at least $400 million. And with that history, then they're less at risk in terms of having to engage in using other tools, which primarily the only one that's left right now is short-term borrowing through a line of credit. This comes out, Madam Chair. In fact, I think you participated some. We did have a special committee dealing with this issue a little over a year ago that was chaired by Senator Pogemiller and myself. To deal with the budget, and one of the big discussion items, if you'll recall, was the cash flow situation and the problems that the state would have if they were forced into short-term borrowing. Now, they had more tools in the toolbox back then, but we've closed some of those off, so the probably in all likelihood it would be a line of credit. Last night in the tax committee, the finance commissioner testified that he was very concerned about the bill that's before us that would create a situation where there would be a high risk in terms of cash flow. I think we're all in agreement probably that we would like to see the school shift paid off, but it does take a revenue stream if you're going to do it right, and that's what we're trying to provide here, and not only a revenue stream, but looking at it long term. So, Madam Chair, I'd also like to request a roll call on this particular amendment as well.
Certainly, Representative Carlson. Representative Garofalo to the A22 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would urge a no vote on the A22 amendment, a preferable strategy to confiscating revenue from the businesses and taxpayers of Minnesota is to grow revenue and grow jobs. That strategy has been working, and I would urge that we continue on that path and urge a no vote.
All right.
I think another member wants to.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I just want to speak specifically to Subdivision 5C. I know we can't use props on the House floor, but maybe in committee. This is the map where all of these tax havens that Representative Carlson were talking about. And this is money that's going to the South Pacific and to the Caribbean and some European places, Central America, Lebanon, Jordan. I mean, this is all money that we can be capturing to offset this so-called shift, which I think is a cut. And so rather than take it from the general fund, let's take it from these tax havens. This is just unconscionable that money from Minnesota that should be going to our general fund is being kept in these countries. So, Madam Chair, I would speak strongly in support of this amendment. And as Representative Winkler said today, we have a choice here between helping our kids out and continuing these tax breaks for overseas corporate activity.
Are there any additional comments or questions on the A22 amendment?
Just a
Representative Carlson.
Quick comment. The language that was used by the author of the bill, confiscating and what have you, just would like to point out that we had a bill up in the Tax Committee today authored by the Chair of the Tax Committee that was also using some FOC money. So because it happens to be offered by a Democrat, and then you start using language, Madam Chair, like confiscating money and that kind of thing is highly inappropriate in my view, and it's a source of revenue that's being looked at by both sides of the aisle.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Any other comments or questions? All right. There's having a roll call been requested by 8-2 amendment. Mr. Smith will take the roll.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Downey.
No.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Abler.
No.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
No.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
No.
Representative Beard.
Nay.
Representative Reinert.
Yes.
Representative Biskins.
Nay.
Representative Champion.
Yes.
Representative Davids.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Eakin.
Yes.
Representative Garofalo.
No.
Representative Gottwalt.
No.
Representative Greiling.
Yes.
Representative Gunther.
No.
Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative House.
No.
Representative Kahn. Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Lanning. Representative Lencheski.
Yes.
Representative McNamara. Representative Nornes.
No.
Representative Pulowski.
No.
Representative Rukavina. Representative Slawick.
Yes.
Representative Smith. Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
Representative Westrum.
No.
By a vote of with 9 ayes, 16 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Now to the bill as amended by the A17 amendment. Any other questions, comments, concerns, final thoughts? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the committee's consideration.
All right, if you did, Representative Garofalo renews his motion that House File 2083 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Garofalo. Representative O'Driscoll, I think, is next. And it's my understanding that Representative Dietrich will be joining Representative O'Driscoll at the stand, as this is an issue that they've both been working on for a number of years. And
And Representative Rukavina, I think, wanted to be here for this, so I don't know where he disappeared to, but.
Tell her we got done at 4 o'clock.
That works, right?
Yeah.
Representative Driscoll, if you could please come to the stand, and if there's a particular document you're looking for, let us know and we'll get it for you. But we're going to get started. Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I'd move House File 2244 be passed and move to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Representative Driscoll, we have the bill in front of us, and I'm wondering if you have any amendments.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you this evening on this. We do have, and I apologize, we did not get these posted, so members have not had a chance to see these. However, they both have bipartisan support from Representative Dietrich and myself, and the first one that they should be coming around at this point. There were copies that were made available. I'm not sure what happened to them. But we have an A7 amendment that really just takes and corrects some words that are commissioned to board. And then one of the things that we had done during committee, and it was suggested, is that we also include in this, and it was a suggestion of Representative Winkler, as well as the commissioner of the DNR, Commissioner Landwehr, that we take a look at putting an audit provision in here so that the Legislative Audit Commission would have the opportunity as well to be able to do this. So those would be the two amendments that we'd be looking at.
All right. Okay, so you'd like these amendments moved to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to discuss.
Yes,
is that
indeed.
Correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Which amendment would you like to take first?
Let's take the A7 amendment.
All right.
Madam Chair, I'd move the A7 amendment.
Representative Downey moves the A7 amendment. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Representative Driscoll, next you'd like somebody to move the...
Move the A-12 amendment, please, Madam Chair.
The A-12-073, I'm assuming...
Madam Chair, I move that.
We'll move that amendment. Any questions on the 743 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A-12-073 amendment is adapted. Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Dietrich, if you want to take it from here and explain your bill to the committee, and in particular, we're most concerned with the fiscal impacts of this bill.
Madam Chair, with your indulgence in that of the committee, I'd like to do just a little bit of background because I think that will help when we get to the fiscal matters. In your packet, there should have been included a graphic that looks like this. And on that graphic, you'll notice at the top, it says beneficiary. And one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that the permanent school land trust properties that we're talking about, the legislature and the executive branch are trustees of this. And it means that in the Enabling Act that created the state of Minnesota, allowed statehood, we set aside certain lands for the benefit of public schools and public school students in the state of Minnesota. As a part of that duty, we owe fiduciary obligations, and so what we are suggesting in this bill is a creation of a permanent school trust board that would consist of 5 members that would be appointed by the governor over 4-year staggered terms, and that we would also have those individuals who the governor would appoint be ratified by the House and the Senate separately. That's part of the reason that for the reason that we're doing that is that we are, as trustees, the legislature and the executive branch, so it ties the two of us together. Members would be looking to have expertise in education, finance, mining, forestry, real estate, fiscal auditing, as well as environmental and renewable energy. They would set policies for the land trust and would hire a director that may contract with the DNR for services to manage such trust lands here in the state of Minnesota. In addition to the board that's being created in this bill, there would also be a substitution of the advisory committee that exists right now in the legislature for permanent land trusts, and in its place we would put a legislative permanent school fund commission. And the purpose behind that commission, it would act from a functional standpoint, hearing any types of bills that would be related to land trust that would come forward in the future, similar to what the Pension Commission does, where they have all of the bills that come in the session to the Pension Commission. It would be made up of 12 members, 6 from the House, 6 from the Senate, and it would also consist of 3 members from each party, so we would have an even balance in both the House and the Senate on that. And this has actually come from some discussions we've had in committees. One of the things that was raised on this was the issue of constitutionality. Representative Wagenius raised that issue in the Environment Committee, and we've worked on that, and we believe we've resolved our constitutional issues. Mm-hmm. Representative Breinhart, you had some concerns about whether there would be citizen input involvement on this. I think we've been able to address that issue as well. One of the things that's also very important to keep in mind is that no additional benefits or sidestepping of state law would be allowed when these properties are moved under the separate commission and board the board supervision. So if there was going to be permitting that would need to be done, that would still be required to be done in accordance with state law. Again, no exceptions or no special privileges being granted to the individuals on that. The second page, which is on the back side, is a timeline of how we would look to transition from the management under the DNR to the separate board that we'd be looking at. Beginning in January of 2013, the Legislative Permanent School Fund Commission would be created. It would have appointees to that from the House and the Senate, and that commission would be able to begin its work immediately. In July of 2013, the board would be appointed, a director would be hired, and begin working with the DNR in a transition plan. By 2014, the Permanent School Board would be assuming the duties related to land trust management. So that brings us to the issue of the fiscal note. And one of the things, if you wanted to grab the fiscal note at this point, you'll notice that there are two areas of question on here. One is there's some legislative costs that are being suggested in the amount of $48,000. What we are advocating is that we would use existing staff, just like we would with staffing any of our other committees or commissions that would be here in the legislative area. So I don't think that that particular number of $48,000 is something that would be a hard cost at this point. As we move forward, there may be a desire to take on some additional research staff to do some additional staffing of that. However, the purpose of this is to bring this under separate management to look for some cost efficiencies and some cost savings. And as a result of that, this would become an independent board that would be taking money from the trust fund to fund some of its operations, similar to what the DNR is doing. But we would, again, endeavor to be looking at those different types of saving. The second area would be that on the front page, we have a $28,200,000 and $475,000 question mark. I guess I would say that these are making some assumptions that aren't necessarily correct as to how we would be staffing the organization. For example, the DNR, when they were consulted and putting this fiscal note together, if you turn to page 6, there's some assumptions that there would be a director that would be hired who would be paid $112,000. There would be some managers that would be put in place and right on down the line. Those are some assumptions that they have made. They are not assumptions that we have made. We are looking, again, to transition this and then see what the needs are, see what the savings are, and then we would look at legislation that would enable us to be able to bring on some of those staff positions if they're needed and desired, as well as funding those through the savings that we would see in the land trust. For example, right now, some of the things that we're eyeballing is that in the state of Minnesota, in statute, the only organization that would pay for fire suppression charges are the school kids in the state of Minnesota. Counties do not pay for that. Corporations who own forest lands do not pay for that. And neither do cities or counties or other entities. The only one that gets charged that is the school kids every year for fire suppression. We think that we can handle that differently, not have to charge the school kids for that in the state of Minnesota. Second area that we're looking at right off the top that I think we can help with some of these expenses would be the area of game and fishing licenses. Currently, the DNR allows hunting on student land trust properties, but there is no fee that is paid back from the game and fishing bills back to the land trust. So in essence, it's a free lease or it's an uncompensated use of that property. So we do believe that there are two areas right there that will far outweigh any kind of fiscal costs that we have. And again, we are questioning whether or not those fiscal costs are things that we would be looking at, if they're just suggestions by the model that the DNR is currently using within the agency. And so with that, I would defer to Representative Dietrich, because this has been a bipartisan bill this year, and Representative Dietrich has a long history in working on this particular matter.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since this is a finance committee, I just wanted to touch on two things, is that I think that this bill allows us to honestly say that we are on, that we have addressed our fiduciary responsibilities when it comes to our school trust lands and their management and the school trust fund, that we are all held in as in the highest, one of the highest responsibilities as trustees. And the other thing that I would just like to point out, a fiscal piece too, is if you look at this flow chart on the bottom left hand side, it says that the that we would hire a director and that they may contract with the DNR, and it is every intention of Representative O'Driscoll and myself is to be working with the DNR, and but the only difference would be is that it, for example, on forestry, as we generate revenue from forestry, right now the DNR subtracts all of their expenses at the end of the year. The only difference in our model would be is that we contract with the DNR up front and we find out what the expenses are going to be up front, and we understand what are the services that they're going to provide for that expense. Because as you all know, as fiduciaries of this land, we need to generate revenue. And so we would know that at the beginning of the year instead of at the end of the year after they've already subtracted their expenses. So those are the two comments I would like to make on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And with that, we stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I wasn't going to bring up the constitutional issue, but since you brought up my name, I feel like I have to. And I am looking on page 8 in section 13, and you make the assertion that we are now constitutional, and it seems to me that when you tell the governor that he has to have the advice and consent of both the House and the Senate acting separately, and that's not part of our Constitution. We don't have that in our Constitution. But if either House fails to confirm the appointment within 45 days, the appointment terminates. What I see there is you have shifted power from the executive, reserved for the executive, to the legislature. I don't think it meets Article 3 of the Constitution. So I think we're going to have some discussions about that on the floor. I this is not the appropriate committee for that, but he brought up my name, and I felt I had to do it. But on the fiscal matter, if I could continue.
Representative Wagenius.
I'm looking at page 3 of the fiscal note, and you kind of glossed over the fiscal implications of this bill, and so I think we need to talk about them. And because you were talking about maybe capturing more money from counties, I'm sure the counties are not thrilled about that, but capturing more money from counties, and you are capturing new hunting and fishing money. I actually agree with that, but there is no, that we would have to raise the fee in order to do that, because right now that account is sliding into the red. So we just have to have that on the record, that these potential new sources of money, counties and the Game and Fish Fund, do not come without the burden of raising property tax or raising a fee. So we just have to understand that. If we want to do that, that's fine. But I think the more important thing there is on page 3, at the next to the last paragraph, it says, currently DNR does not certify all of the cost it incurs in managing school trust lands. It then, DNR then gives you a list of costs that it does not certify. So those costs are now paid by the general fund, by bonding, Game and Fish Fund. So what the DNR concludes is that if these costs are charged to the trust, and they legitimately will be under your plan, there will be a $2.3 million decrease in revenue to the corpus of the school trust fund. That's huge. So you're advertising to the public that we're going to get more money for kids, which every one of us wants to do, no question. But this is actually a revenue decrease. And I think in this committee, we all have to address that pretty forthrightly. The second thing is that's not brought up is that there, the way this is structured, DNR now has to pay PILT payments, including PILT payments to schools. But the way you've got this bill structured, there will be no more PILT payments, including PILT payments to schools. So these are the issues that this committee has to wrestle with, and it's for because we do not have something that we can tell Minnesotans. In theory, we would love to give more money to the kids, but this doesn't do it. This doesn't do it right now. I know we all want to do it, but this is the route that's taking us in the wrong direction.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I would what I would have to argue is that I don't think the evidence is there. What I would say what this model does is it says we are going to be fiscally responsible and we are going to know what our costs are up front before we spend them. And I don't know how we can say that the current model is working. You know, in regards to forestry, there have been, you know, and I don't know that we want to get into all this, but there have been 10 years out of the forestry history where the expenses outweighed the revenue. And then once again in 2009, the DNR spent every dime that they made on school trust lands. And so the whole goal of this new director is to say we can't continue like that. And there might have to be different decisions made. And I think that we just need somebody who is willing to look at different options for doing things. And it might not be, you know, we just talked about this a little bit. Think about if a person just decided we're going to lease our forestry land to the DNR and they can just pay us a flat rate for foresting our land. Instead of nitpicking on are these real expenses or are they not, because nobody can really verify they are or are not. Right now, if you know, at least when I look at a certification report, I don't really understand if all those expenses are true, authentic. There is no evidence of that, just because they're there on paper. And so I remember back to Kevin Carter, who was here from the state of Utah, and not that I'm trying to replicate their lands, but it is their model, because he was held accountable to the trustees, to the beneficiaries. He was able to have a monthly report on the amount of money that he spent and what kind of revenue did that generate on that activity. And we are very far away from that right now. And so that would at least be one step where at least we know. Having the fiduciary responsibility for these lands and for that account, I think that if nothing else, at a minimum, we have to know.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually agree that we should have much better accounting from DNR for expenses. But right now, DNR is telling us they're not even certifying all the expenses that they have. And I'm quite sure they're right about that. They are not. When I look at those expenses and I see the subsidy that's actually coming from the general fund to DNR to run forestry, it's huge. It's a huge. And about half of the lands that they harvest are DNR lands that are not trust lands, but probably more than half are trust lands. So I don't think all the costs are being certified. I think that's legitimate. And I would totally agree that we need better accounting from DNR. But I don't want us to mislead Minnesotans into thinking they're going to get a lot of money out of this, and particularly a lot of money out of forestry. It's not there. That's what bothers me about this bill. It's not that we shouldn't have better accounting. And if we had required lots more accounting, I'd go with every bit of it. But let's not promise to citizens something we can't deliver.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Wiggins, I don't think anybody was promising lots of money. I don't think that that was ever said. What has been said, though, is that we have found expenses that possibly shouldn't have been, that are unfair and have been charged to the trust because they can be. And the example that Representative O'Driscoll gave was the fire suppression. And I would, from my general overview of looking at this for 5 years, I would say that there are other costs that are not necessarily directly related to the revenue generated off of our land. And when you have a fiduciary responsibility, a trustee responsibility, you if you even spend one dime of money on land for another interest, meaning the state versus the trust land, you are in breach of trust. Even if it's a dime, you are to have that level of accountability and record keeping so that you know those things. And I would contend up until this point we don't have any. And at that point I would say that we are even in jeopardy of legal action at some point. So that would be my response. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, if I could just I apologize. I would like to respond to some of the things that were directed at me in this. If I could direct members to page 13 of the bill, section 25, the PILT payments that Representative Wagenius was referring to are included in the bill, so we are keeping those local jurisdictions whole. The other item that I want to just visit about is we are not doing anything that, when we talk about the House and the Senate voting on confirmation, we do that right now with the Campaign Finance Board, that the House and the Senate do go ahead and approve those. And Senate has had and does have confirmation authority for gubernatorial appointments. And because this is a House bill and because of the nature of the fact that we are acting in a fiduciary capacity, we did not want to cut the House out of this, so we wanted to have the House and the Senate be involved in voting on the confirmations, since we have as equal a fiduciary obligation as our counterparts in the Senate do on this.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank Representative Dietrich and Representative O'Driscoll for this bill, and I do have to say, you know, for the newer members, that this is an issue I've been chasing, like a dog chasing his tail for 26 years. I'm glad somebody finally caught their tail. But, you know, Representative Wiggenius, the issues you brought up on page 3 are really insignificant as far as dollars are concerned. And I actually don't even know, for example, costs for oversight. What are they overseeing? I have no idea what that means in DNR lingo. Campground maintenance, it's such a small amount of money, it makes no sense. Now, how do you market school trust land? I mean, maybe that's a question I hate to ask Mr. Kramka or anybody. Reforestation, I know a lot of this land is aspen and it regenerates itself. You know, the DNR has had well over two decades to address some of the questions that some of us have been asking, and I'm glad that this bill has gone to this point that finally they're starting to answer some questions. I do have some concerns about the makeup of the board. You know, Representative O'Driscoll, I talked to you this afternoon, I believe it was, about it. I like the Legislative Commission. I think it's a great idea, one that should have been around for a long time. I have a real problem, and Representative McNamara and others know that I have a problem with citizens being on boards. And I don't know how you address that, but to me, your school trust land board is troubling to me. And, you know, in other states, and you probably know that, departments of administration or management and budget operate, and maybe that's a better approach as we go down this road. But I do also have some other concerns, and I know they're not yours, but, you know, we have a lot of money going into the Permanent University Fund at our land-grant college that isn't addressed in this bill, because I think some of the money you're talking about that's been
with no accounting at all, has also been some of their money. And the PILT issue, I thought we had discussed that with, that I had discussed that with you too, and I thought that was kind of promised that it would be taken care of. But, you know, Representative Howes and Representative McNamara know a little bit, at least on this committee, maybe a few others. No one sells their stumpage for nothing. And, you know, I've got some beautiful trees that are worth $100 a cord, whether they're old growth white pine or whatever. I wouldn't sell them for nothing. No one on this committee would sell stumpage for nothing. I'd rather just let the birds and the bees and the owls and everybody else play in it and watch them fall over and drop before I'd go through the trouble of selling stumpage for nothing. And that's what's been going on from 1980, I believe, to 91. It was an 11-year period where nothing, $4, $3, $5 million a year of stumpage for nothing. And we got them up and jacked them up a little bit, and I remember there was a point where they were bragging that they were putting 30 cents on a dollar into the fund, and now it's dropped with your figures back down to almost nothing. So, Representative Wagenius, there is a way to make money on stumpage. Everybody does that, has stumpage, sells it, and gets, if it's sold for $30 a cord, you don't get zero, you get $30 a cord. But the school kids have gotten zero most of the time. And that's, and there's a big amount of money that could come in from that. And one other thing I have to say, because the word trustee keeps coming up all the time, and a lot of us are guilty a few years ago. You know, the Department of Natural Resources in a land exchange back in 1998, where we forced a land exchange on the DNR that didn't want to do it, for people who had lakeshore leases on school trust land, and the DNR demanded that we exchange lakeshore for lakeshore. And I asked at the time how lakeshore was going to generate money for the school kids. And now the school kids own 20-some miles of shoreline on Lake Vermilion that over the last 13 years that they got it has generated, guess what, Madam Chair? Nothing. Now, what kind of a trustee would have not at least gone to the United States Steel Corporation in 3 or 4 years ago, whenever it was that the governor wanted to establish a new state park on Lake Vermilion next to the old state park, but that I didn't support. But anyway, you know, a trustee would have said, let's give the school kids and exchange some land here and give the school kids $18 million or $16 million, whatever they gave U.S. Steel. And instead, U.S. Steel got $16 or $18 million, and the school kids got nothing. So if nothing else has happened here this year and last, we have finally gotten somebody's attention. I'm not blaming Commissioner Landwehr or Governor Dayton on this, but, you know, there's been more than enough abuse from both sides of the aisle, and I am glad you've gotten it to this point, and I congratulate you. And I still think there's got to be a lot of work done on this bill, but particularly the makeup of that trustee, because it makes me nervous. Other than that, you've got a good start, and I just commend you on it.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To build on what Representative Rukavina has just said, in my conversations with the commissioner, I have not laid this solely at his feet. This has been 150 years in the making since we've had statehood, where we've gotten ourselves into the position that we're in. And I do not believe that we're going to solve it in 1 year, but this is the way we can make the 90-degree turn to start getting back into a direction that does benefit our students in, here in the state of Minnesota. And we have that opportunity here this evening to move this bill, and the opportunity to work on the floor and to work with our counterparts in the Senate to get something that we can all live with to help out with what obviously has, from my short time having been here, certainly is a burr under an awful lot of people's saddles that we can put it to rest once and for all.
Madam Chair, if I could see one last
thing.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I don't know who's chair. I do want to say one last thing, too, and that is to make it perfectly clear to the members of this committee and anybody else listening that the 80-plus percent of the $770 million in the corpus of the school trust has come from mining. And for those that are, you know, reluctant about mining and don't really support mining, I want you to know that over the next several years, you know, there's going to be better than $11 million a year going into the Permanent University Fund, and close to $30 million now a year because of MNTAC mining going into the school trust. So it seems to be something that the DNR and the story and the School Trust Advisory Committee and everybody else, a story that doesn't get out there. It's our mineral wealth that has been putting a lot of money into everybody's school districts in this state.
Representative Dietrich.
Just a little point of information. I hope that that is true, because when I look at the permanent school fund, although it was at this point projections, in 2011 it's $721 million, and it's projected to increase by $1 million in 2012. And, you know, I think this is just one more indication how we need somebody who is acting on behalf of the children every single day, all day, 7 days a week, and monitoring the land use, the revenue generated, and the fund, and the results, and how it's delivered to the schools. Because they're, like Representative Rukavina said, there's been a lot of abuse going on by everybody sitting in this room, actually. And that I can point to is for over 50 years, we have been generating revenue out of this permanent school fund and then subtracting it. So the kids never got their revenue over and above. And that is everybody here in this room's responsibility. So there is enough places to lay blame. But what we would like to do is quit blaming and quit the finger pointing and say it's the legislators' fault, it's the DNR's, and now we're going to include the federal government. And we would like to quit the blaming and look to the future and see how we can fix this. So thank you.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick concerns around the fire suppression discussion. Representative O'Driscoll mentioned that was a possible way of addressing the costs in the fiscal note, and I think both of you referred to the fire suppression as a possible area in which someone, the DNR maybe, I don't know, has been negligent in terms of charging that cost to the school trust lands. My understanding is that was a legislative decision, and not the DNR's responsibility, so that isn't a faulty accounting on their part. But my question is why, if indeed that's a mechanism for addressing some of the elements of the fiscal note, why isn't it addressed in your bill?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Breinhardt, I would just ask for clarification when you say not addressed in the bill. What is the pronoun that's being addressed in the bill? I'm not exactly sure which particular item you're talking about.
Representative Breinhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The actual statute that charges the school trust lands to pay for fire suppression costs.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, Representative Breinhardt, that was a conscious decision to not include things in here because we didn't want this to become every legislator who has an issue to be put into the bill to try to address those kinds of things. We wanted to build a structure, and then with the commission, we would take those things next year, fire suppression, fees, some of the things that Representative Rukavina had talked about, put it in front of the commission, get them working on those kinds of things so that we're moving forward with a plan. And that's part of what we don't have is a long-range plan right now.
Representative Brennan? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And one, I'd like to follow up quick on Representative Breinhardt. Representative Breinhardt, you're right. It's we have to be careful about pointing fingers at the DNR and being negligent. It's this body that's been negligent for the last 20 years. I mean, I can go through fire suppression. We told them to do that because that was an easy money to grab. Why are we not charging fees to the school trust land for hunting and fishing? Why should they be able to hunt and fish on that land for free? We haven't done that, right? Why do we have them log in the time when the market's down to help out the industry? Why would we log when Popple's at $25 on the school trust land? Why does DNR do that? Because the legislature wants them to keep the mills running. Is that the constitutional? No. The Constitution says we're supposed to maximize it for the kids. The DNR is doing what the legislature's done. The statutes are full of stuff. We tried to remove one last year. It says something about manage the school trust land for environmental.
We can't break law today when we manage the school trust land. Why do we have duplicated twice on one page in statute telling the DNR to manage for environmental purposes? That statute's not consistent with the Constitution. I mean, I can keep going. And then to talk about, well, they're only managing it for a 10% return. I'm sorry, if you're in the mining business, the insurance business, the landscape business, the lawyer business, and you could earn 10% profit, you'd be very, very happy. I don't know if we're going to get more money by changing this up or less, but we're going to be constitutional, and that's what we need to be. I'm sorry, finally the legislature, after all these years, is facing the facts that maybe we should be doing this right. Who's the best one to manage the land actually on the ground? I don't know that anybody's going to do better than the DNR as far as their foresters on the ground or their iron people. I mean, I look at Marty Vadas and the great work he did on behalf of DNR and negotiating the stuff. I mean, I don't know if anybody could do better, but at least we're going to have an accounting and know how many hours they worked and if it was done right, because somebody at the top is going to be a numbers person. And I just really want to say, Representative Dietrich, Representative Driscoll, and Representative Rukavina, who have worked hard on this for a long time, I'm glad we've got it to this point. It's got more work to do, Representative Rukavina. You mentioned that this board and some things we need to work through and find out how we can get the governor and the agency to look at this as a positive thing. And I think Commissioner Landwehr has gone a long, long ways towards being willing to make change and realizing we're serious on this. So this is not the last stop where it's at now. I realize that, and it's got more work, and I want to help make it happen. But we have to change, members. What we're doing currently is it's not acceptable to the kids. And Representative Rukavina, you're right. All this lakeshore on Lake Vermilion, there's all kinds of great lots that could be sold off, developed, whatever, and probably should be. And it hasn't been the DNR telling them not to sell it. It hasn't been. I don't think the DNR cares if it's sold or not. You know, if we keep instructing them to do what they're doing, they're going to keep doing what they're doing. So hopefully we'll get it changed. And sorry to go on for so long, but I'm just really glad that both of you are working together, and I look forward to making this happen.
Thank you, Representative McMahon. Representative Rukavina.
Just one last question to both of you. Are you willing to talk to the university about their issue, too, in this bill, or you don't totally want it separate? Because I think they've kind of gotten tossed by the wayside, even though the PUF fund is about $340 million.
Representative O'Driscoll.
The bill does not address the university or the state university land trust program. That may be something that we'll take up next session, but it's not contemplated for this. It's just the scope right now of the school land trust. And as a matter of fact, in some of the numbers that we've received in our process and research on this with MMB, we've had to have them separate out the numbers so they have those numbers when it is time to start moving forward with the university lands as well.
Representative Rukavina.
And one last thing, and Representative McNamara, you know, I do have that bill you can help on Vermilion. I want to keep that land for the people of this state and add it to the Vermilion State Park and have legacy funds to do that, and I know you support me on that.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the point on the university lands, if this bill gets to a conference committee, that might be an appropriate time to talk about that. Somebody from the university did talk to me a year ago and just said, we want in on whatever you're doing, and I just kind of said, well, then you have to at least show up, and I haven't seen them since. And so, but it might be a time to, because they have it's the same fiduciary responsibilities, it's the same type of lands and same type of obligations. So I think that would be a very easy merging of two interests.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Final statement, or I think we're ready to vote. But
I think I've shared my comments along the way. I asked for the committee's support.
Thank you both. I would renew my motion that House File 2244, as amended, be passed and placed on the general register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
Motion carries. The bill is passed to the general register. And members, we are adjourned.
Right here.